From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with journalist Nicholas von Hoffman. His new book is a biography of Roy Cohn, the controversial attorney who was chief counsel to Joseph McCarthy. Also today, I speak with Mary Morris about traveling alone as a single woman. Her new book, Nothing to Declare, chronicles her solo trip through Mexico and Central America. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of big band music from Woody Herman. And television critic David Bianculli reviews The Street, a new cop series with a documentary look. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Nicholas von Hoffman has just completed the biography of a man he detests, the late Roy Cohn. With his arch-conservative politics and unethical legal practices, Cohn made a lot of enemies, but his fame and power helped him keep a lot of friends at the top. Roy Cohn first made his mark at the age of 23 as an attorney for the prosecution in the spy trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. At the age of 26, he became chief counsel to Joseph McCarthy and helped lead the hunt for communists. Even his subsequent career in private practice was controversial. He was disbarred by New York State shortly before his death from AIDS in 1986. Journalist Nicholas von Hoffman never met Roy Cohn, but as part of his research, he interviewed many of Cohn's friends and enemies. Von Hoffman is a syndicated columnist who has written for the Chicago Daily News, the Washington Post, and many magazines. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. I pointed out to him that most biographers choose subjects they admire, but von Hoffman did not admire Roy Cohn.
No, I didn't. And in fact, I was very surprised as I went along in the research how I disadmired him. Every day I've disadmired Roy a little more.
Are there problems unique to doing a biography of someone who you detest?
Yes. There's going crazy.
That's a good one.
There is getting, particularly with a guy who indulged in extortion, blackmail, drove people to suicide, things like that. You can, I think, fall into a kind of black cynicism. I mean, you come home at night and you've heard yet one more depressing tale about, you know, fallen human nature, and it can get to you so that you have to keep your morale up. And you have to keep looking for, I suppose, what we might call the good side of your subject.
Yeah, well, that brings up the issue of how do you be fair? What does fairness mean in the context of this? Is someone who you hated more and more as you got deeper and deeper into your into his life? So what did the word fairness start to mean?
Well, I think fairness means this. At least I'm sure that for every biographer it means something different. For me, it meant trying to purge myself of my preconceptions. It meant not having a kind of quiet political agenda that I wanted to prove. For example, not going at this thing to show that the Rosenbergs were innocent, or the reverse. In other words, to try and be as much as possible a tabula rasa and let this story imprint itself on me, and then only then to begin to put it together in some kind of background of history and society.
In your opening chapter, you deal with one of the many great ironies of Roy Cohn's life, and that is that he was staunchly anti-gay throughout his life, yet he was a homosexual, and he in fact died of AIDS. What are some of the ways that he spoke out against homosexuals?
Well, he did it even going way back to the 1950s when he was running around Europe trying to find people in the State Department who were supposed to be communists. He was always making these very self-conscious remarks about homosexuals. And then right up until the year shortly before his death, he would go to pro-family life meetings and make wisecracks about it. Even in gay bars, there's an incident of his being stopped while he's having a drink with a friend of his in one of New York's most famous gay bars. This guy comes up to him and says something to the effect, will you help on the gay rights bill? And not only does he say no, but he makes a wicked remark about the subject.
Now, one of the people on his personal staff actually acted as his procurer.
That's right. In fact, there were in the course of his life, he had several procurers, but Russell, who died of AIDS, was his procurer for some time. And as another person on his staff said to me, the first thing Roy wants to know when he wakes up in the morning is who is he going to go to sleep with tonight?
And he'd pay $100 to that person.
Yes. Oh, and much more. The $100 is that was for a Twinkie for the evening, but for long-term lovers, there was a great deal of money to be made. Not every lover made it, but I mean, some, you know, they have nothing more to show for it than a Rolex or two, but others have a lot of real estate and other kinds of property. And because he often used, not always, but he often used his lovers as fronts for his phony bank accounts.
Now, from the way you describe it, Roy Cohn is the kind of person who can have sexual relationships with other men and still not think of himself as being gay.
That's right. He looked at himself in the mirror and he said, "I've got hair on my chest. My wrist is not limp. I do not lisp. Ergo, I am not gay." And he never saw himself as gay.
So instead of him saying, "Therefore, that stereotype is a stupid one," he'd say, "Therefore, I can't be gay."
Exactly. He can, you know, and it has a certain kind of mad logic. Also, of course, we're dealing with a man who struggled early in the years of his life to achieve heterosexuality. And again, I think in fairness to this man, you have to realize that in the years that he grew up, being gay was, or homosexual, because the word gay has a different connotation, being homosexual was regarded as a disease, something to be cured. One of the things that happened to people in that era when they were caught, arrested for homosexual acts is that they were forced to go to psychiatrists. So that he could well see this as something that he was battling against to try and get over.
My guest is journalist Nicholas von Hoffman, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Citizen Cohn, The Life and Times of Roy Cohn. Now, this must have raised a lot of interesting issues, ethical issues for you as a journalist. I mean, someone's private life is their private life. He chose to remain in the closet for his life and to not even define himself as a homosexual. But as a journalist, you were really kind of digging up what kind of gay life he actually had. What kind of ethical questions did you have to deal with in figuring out what was really best left as personal stuff and what really should be made public?
Well, I think the task was made easier for me in that I was dealing in writing this biography with somebody who is dead. And I think history has claims that I'm not sure journalism has. I think we can say that newspaper writers, broadcasters really have, there should be very strict limits into how far they ought to inquire into the private lives of living people. But once somebody is dead, he or she no longer has a private life, and biography, by definition, wants to look into people's private lives, and it is a poor biographer indeed who does not do it, and of course most of our great biographies do it. So that I don't think that is a problem. I think we have a second thing here that makes looking into Roy's private life very important. Because one of the great questions a book like this raises is, do we have, in an egalitarian democracy, two standards of life? Because Roy, Ronald Reagan, a great many of the people that Roy was closely associated with politically and socially, are people who advanced public policies, legislation, etc., which proposes to reinforce a pro-family, monogamous heterosexuality, and in fact envisions penalties of one kind or another for people who don't follow this. And yet we find there is a class of very privileged people who lead a very different life. And we have to ask ourselves, can this go on, particularly on a large scale, in a quasi-public way, without ultimately doing serious injury to the civic morale?
No, I understand that one of the ways that you found out about some of Roy Cohn's personal life was to put ads asking for information from people who have been with him. You put ads in papers that are read by many gay people, like the Village
yes.
Voice and gay papers in New York.
Yes, The Advocate, and et cetera, yes.
So when someone came to you and said, yeah, I had a sexual encounter with Roy Cohn, how did you check them out? How do you know they're telling you the truth?
Well, if they simply were saying, oh, I had a sexual encounter with Roy Cohn, I really wasn't very interested, because you could find hundreds of such people. And so they had, unless they had some other kind of relationship with Roy, it was simply, you know, a brief moment of carnality. What I was looking for was people who, you might say, stayed around for breakfast and perhaps even for lunch, and therefore who could shed some light, significant light, on Roy's life. And here you very quickly develop a whole set of kind of questions that you can use with such people that tell you whether or not they really were close to him, whether they were around.
Like what?
Well, for example, who was Roy's houseboy, if you claim to be there, you know, in, say, in the 1970s? Or what was the name of his boat, if it was the 1960s? Who was the captain of the boat? All kinds of things that you couldn't know unless you were really there. And if these people blustered, and some of them did, because I got a lot of calls from people whose hatred of Roy was so great that it was clear after I talked to them for a while that they were making up stories that weren't true.
Mm-hmm.
I also had to, for example, with the police, they made allegations about Roy that I couldn't, I just felt they couldn't really prove. So that I didn't put them in the book. For example, there has been a great deal of talk in New York about an alleged ring of pedophiles operating, more or less basing themselves in the Plaza Hotel in the late 1970s. And Roy is placed by certain, you know, police officers as being part of this group. I was never able to really substantiate this, and therefore I decided that I couldn't put it in the book.
Now, Roy Cohn prosecuted the Rosenbergs, and you write that he said that he never had 2 seconds doubt about the Rosenbergs' guilt, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. But there are things, he says, that he would have done differently, such as the McCarthy hearings. What do you think he would have done differently?
Well, I think he would have been more careful. I mean, one of the things that stands out when you go back and you look at that record is just how sloppy and haphazard and wacky it all was. I think he would have done that differently. I think he might also have handled the politics leading up to the Army McCarthy hearings differently. He left not only himself, but his boss and his protector and mentor, Joe McCarthy, extremely vulnerable. In fact, really, the immediate cause of Joe McCarthy's destruction was, ironically, Roy Cohn.
How so?
Well, for example, Roy Cohn had this obsession with a young G. David Shine, a very wealthy young man who, Harvard graduate, very handsome guy, that Roy brought on McCarthy's staff as a, quotes, unpaid consultant. This love was not reciprocated by Shine, who is a heterosexual. Nevertheless, Roy went crazy about this guy. And in the course of going crazy about him, when the guy was drafted, demanded all sorts of special privileges for this guy from the Army, calling up high officials in the Pentagon and shrieking, David is going to have to do KP the next day unless you do something to stop it. That kind of thing. This was all stockpiled, noted and stockpiled by the Army to be used against McCarthy when the time came. And the time came more or less when Eisenhower woke up one morning and said, hey, whose army is this? McCarthy's and Cohn's are mine. It's my army. I want this stuff stopped.
You tell a great story about the classical harmonica player Larry Adler, who was called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he was asked to name names, and he refused. And you describe how Roy Cohn took him aside and said, "Look, we'll give you a list of names to name. You could just name these names, and we already know about them, so you won't be damaging any other reputations."
Exactly. Name already named names.
So what is the logic behind that?
Oh, I think it's the logic of the political show trial. I mean, I think that's the logic. It's the same kind of thing that that they do in Russia. It's the public breaking and humiliation. It's the groveling. It is the giving up so that everybody can see it. It is political humiliation and degradation.
Did you think Roy Cohn was the kind of person who liked to see people humiliated and degraded?
I don't know. No. Well, he did in one sense. He loved to do it as an exercise in power. So that we have many years later his knocking Will Hellerstein out of a federal judgeship for really no other reason than to show muscle. And every so often he did that. But here I think there was also policy involved. I mean, this was a way of establishing both a personal political position, but and also a general public position that, you know, he wanted people to behave a certain way. He wanted them to have a certain kind of politics. And certainly one way to do that, to frighten them off, shall we say, left positions or that kind of thing, was to take somebody who wasn't a communist, etc., and give him a public humiliation like that.
Well, I want to talk with you more about Roy Cohn, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is journalist Nicholas von Hoffman, whose new book is titled Citizen Cohn, The Life and Times of Roy Cohn. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with Nicholas von Hoffman about his new book, Citizen Cohn. Once the McCarthy hearings were over and Cohn went, you know, more into private practice, what kind of cases did he handle? And then I want to ask you about his ethics as a lawyer. But what kind of cases did he specialize in?
It was a very broad range of cases, all the way from divorces, which he did a lot of, and some spectacular ones, all the way to gangster cases, to sort of run-of-the-will things like wills, that sort of stuff. It was a general law practice. He was not a specialist.
Now, you describe him selling out many of his clients.
Yes.
What are some of the ways he would do that?
Well, I think, for example, he had one client who was the owner of a discotheque. And this client gave him certain information that was privileged, that is, information between a lawyer and a client. He used this information in order to try to spring two other clients of his from the jaws of the federal government. In other words, he said, look, I'll feed you information on client one if you free client two. He did things like that. And he also, in divorce cases, He particularly, it would seem, if he would sell out the women if they were his clients.
Will you describe how he would take privileged information and give it to the gossip columnists?
Yes, and you did that all the time. Roy not only fought you in the courtroom, but really that was almost the last place that he fought you. The first place that he fought you, and he could savage you, would be in the public prints and the broadcasting. And we were talking about a guy who, going all the way back to the days of Walter Winchell, was able to plant stuff on the air and in the papers. In fact, he wrote a lot of Winchell's material. And right up until shortly before he died, he had a similar kind of relationship with a man like Bill Sapphire.
Here's something that I really find to be a mystery about the man. He ruined many lives during the McCarthy era. As a lawyer, he was very unethical in his own professional behavior. And as if that weren't enough, you describe him being a real pig when he'd eat out, like eating off of everybody else's plate, and then running his finger along the icing of the dessert tray so he could sample a little bit of everything. Now, but here's a man who had so many powerful friends. And when he threw a party, everybody would come. And he was friends with so many people at the top. What was so attractive about him as a friend that so many people gravitated around him?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Of course, one is that he was extremely useful, but that alone wouldn't account for it. It should be said that he was useful in big ways. I mean, he could get you a $40 million tax abatement, and he could also get you tickets to a show that no one could get tickets to. I mean, he ran a full-service store when it came to favors. But beyond that, he could be, when he wanted to be, he could be charming, he could be thoughtful, he could be helpful, he could be a kind of Dutch uncle, he could be a shoulder to cry on, he could be a source of psychological security. You know, people would always say, oh, I remember Roy saying, don't worry about it, I'll take care of it. He could counsel you in your marriage. He could do all sorts of things like that. And then finally, as he collected celebrities and powerful people, he reached a kind of critical mass of folks who were following him around and going to his parties. And at that point, I think it produces a magnetic field, and you suck in more and more and more people.
Well, here's something else that you describe. You describe how the newspaper coverage by the 70s had turned favorable for him, with the exception of three papers, the New York Daily News, the American Lawyer, and the Village Voice. Why that kind of change in the way he was treated in the press?
Well, I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he had so much influence with so many people in the press, and that includes broadcast, too, at various levels. And it could be, for example, that with certain important television executives, he took care of their divorces and often sent them no bills. For example, David Susskind, but also certain network executives. And the next thing you know, you saw him on this network show or that network show being glamorized. He had a relationship with the top people in some of the most important newspaper chains, such as the Newhouse newspaper chain, very, very close to the Newhouse family. He had, and then, of course, he would do anything to cultivate the goodwill of reporters and editors. And I think it is important to realize that he did it on every level.
Can I ask you something? As a journalist yourself, did this make you more cynical about the press, or were you not surprised to find this?
Well, I think all of us in journalism know about this. We know the various forms of corruption in our industry. That it should be as pervasive, I mean, that he should be so pervasively successful in such important organizations is disturbing. I mean, it is certainly, if you look at the pattern of coverage of Roy, the last, 18, 15 years of his life in the New York Times, you really do have to be concerned. That they should do sort of puff piece after puff piece about his parties. At the same time, when in 1979, the New York Daily News is doing a series, a brutal, well-documented, well-researched series, showing this man, in fact, to be a criminal. This is hard to reconcile. This puffery of Roy went on in the media even after he had been thrown out of Martindale and Hubbell, the directory which lists all the attorneys in the United States. He was thrown out for ethical reasons, and I can tell you it is almost as difficult to be thrown out of Martindale and Hubbell as it is out of the Yellow Pages. But Roy managed to do it. And yet, there is no mention of this in a paper like the New York Times, which continued to write about him. I mean, it'd be another matter if they just dropped any mention of him, but they continue to write about him in the most flattering terms.
Now, I know that as part of your research, you wanted to get access to Roy Cohn's FBI Freedom of Information Act files, but you weren't able to do that. What were the obstacles that stood in your way?
Well, I think the obstacles, he had a terribly compromised relationship with J. Edgar Hoover. I think that what I was dealing with, I mean, I simply have gotten back sheets and sheets of blacked out information. The Justice Department, when I put in the application, and this was now several years ago, I got back from the Justice Department a letter saying the file is 4,000 pages long. I've seen very, very little of it. I think this is protection of the institution. After all, their headquarters is lodged in a building that says in stone right above the doors, the J. Edgar Hoover Building. And I just think that it is a kind of reflexive institutional covering up and clutching up, that they just don't want this out, the relationship between Roy and this man who made this organization. But we still have a great deal of information on what went on between the two of them, and it's pretty fantastic stuff.
Can we mention the other book?
Certainly.
Sidney Zion has also written a book about Roy Cohn that is based largely on Cohn's own notes. Cohn was in the process of writing an autobiography when he died and had asked Sidney Zion to work on it for him. So Zion kind of picked up the ball after Cohn died. Now, what are some of the dilemmas it poses for you when you find out that there's another book in the works on the same subject that you're writing?
Well, it doesn't really pose any dilemma. In fact, I mentioned the autobiography in my biography. I have a scene in there describing Roy working on it. I think what we're dealing with are two very different documents, that an autobiography is not the same thing as a biography. For people who are mad enough to do it, to become complete Roy Buff fans, I suggest they read both books, because they're essentially complementary. I think if I had heard that somebody was writing a biography, another biography, well, obviously I would have been disturbed, because I'd say, well, I don't know whether there's room for both of them.
I'm not asking for a book review of Zion's book, but I'm wondering if you read it the moment you could get your hands on it.
No, actually I didn't, because by the time it came out, I was reaching the point where I was saying, you know, 2 years of my life devoted to Roy is enough. Ça suffit.
Did you have to find out new ways of getting people to talk with you? You mentioned somewhere that it's hard to get people to talk about a subject like Roy Cohn because they're afraid it might incriminate them in some way.
That's right.
So how did you encourage people to talk with you?
Well, one of the things, for some people, I tried to take the tack, which sometimes worked and sometimes didn't, of, look, history has her claims. The Cleo, the goddess of history, you really owe something to her. This man, these events are so important that they should be recorded. With other people, or some of Roy's close friends, I said to them, look, you saw what happened with the Frank Sinatra biography. Don't let the same thing happen to Roy Cohn, whom you loved, because basically what you will be doing is letting Roy's enemies only write his biography. Don't just let Roy's enemies do it. You loved him. You thought highly of him. Tell me about it. I solemnly promise these words will find their way into this biography.
We are technically out of time, but very briefly, did it work?
Nothing works 100%, but it worked fairly well. I got the cooperation of some people that I am delighted and surprised that they would cooperate.
Well, Nicholas von Hoffman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Nicholas von Hoffman. His columns are syndicated by King Features in newspapers across the country, and his articles occasionally appear in The New Republic and Spy magazine. His new book, Citizen Cohn, is published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Simon Rattle. He's the conductor of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, and he's currently on tour in the United States. He's credited with causing a major change in Britain's orchestral scene by creating a new legitimacy for the regional orchestras. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Mary Morris goes on the road alone and learns to scream if you must, smile when you can, and travel light. Her new travel book chronicles her trip through Mexico and Central America. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of big band leader Woody Herman and his first and second herds. And television critic David Bianculli reviews The Street, a new cop show shot documentary style in Newark, New Jersey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The hijackers of the Kuwaiti airliner at Larnaca Airport in Cyprus have carried out their threat to kill another of their hostages on board the plane. The second hostage was killed after Cypriot authorities refused to refuel the plane and allow it to take off for a neutral country. Details from Jim Muir.
When they announced that they'd killed the Kuwaiti hostage, the hijackers warned that they would carry out similar dangerous actions, as they put it, if the plane were not refueled immediately. But some 9 hours have passed since then, with long periods of silence descending on the radio communications between the airliner and the control tower. After the murdered hostage's body was thrown out onto the tarmac, about 3 hours elapsed before the control tower renewed contact, making arrangements for yet another brief trip out to the plane by the PLO mediator who's been leading the contact with the hijackers. The control tower said he wanted to talk to them about refueling the plane. But more than 4 more hours have passed since then, with no further sign of activity, apart from arrangements for food to be taken on board. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir at Larnaca Airport in Cyprus.
The United States criticized Israel today for expelling 8 Palestinian activists to Lebanon. State Department spokesman Charles Redman expressed the administration's disappointment and regret at Israel's action.
We strongly oppose deportations from the occupied territories. As we have said before, we believe that they're counterproductive, that they're in violation of the 4th Geneva Convention, and that they only further inflame passions.
Israeli authorities said the 8 Palestinians are terrorists who were involved in inciting unrest in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Palestinians said the expulsions will only lead to more violence. President Reagan announced today that he is sending Secretary of State George Shultz to Geneva later this week to represent the U.S. at the signing of the Afghan peace settlement. The president also said the U.S. will join the Soviet Union as a guarantor of the proposed agreement. More from NPR's Brian Naylor.
Under the agreement, the Soviet Union will begin withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan May 15th. Half of those troops will be sent home in the first 3 months of the accord, with the rest due out by February 1989. In announcing his support for the agreement, President Reagan claimed victory.
This development would not have been possible had it not been for the valiant struggle of the Afghan people to rid their country of foreign occupation. We take great pride in having assisted the Afghan people in this triumph, and they can count on our continued support.
The president denied that U.S. support for the agreement was a sellout of the Afghan rebels. Secretary of State Shultz said the rebels will continue to receive what he called good, strong support from the U.S., which will last for as long as Soviet assistance to the Kabul government does. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The RAND Corporation released a report today questioning the effectiveness of legislation over the past 10 years aimed at improving the nation's public education. The report shows that hundreds of bills have been enacted across the country, increasing teachers' pay and tightening rules governing training and certification. But the survey says a key question has been left unresolved, that is, whether teachers are professionals serving the needs of individual students or semi-skilled workers needing constant supervision and regulation. Pat Robertson's presidential campaign has turned over its financial records to the Internal Revenue Service. The IRS is currently investigating the tax-exempt status of the Christian Broadcasting Network, the religious cable network founded by Robertson. CBN has been a big donor to another organization, the Freedom Council, which helped set up the Robertson campaign. If the money from CBN was used for the campaign itself, then the tax-exempt status of the broadcasting network would be in jeopardy. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 6 points to close at 2095.99. Advances led decline 7-5 on volume of 147 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new Woody Herman reissue. Herman died last October at the age of 75. Up until his final illness, Herman was on the road playing the clarinet, the alto saxophone, and leading his band. The new reissue features the first post-war bands that Herman led.
Woody Herman's last years, he'd become more famous for his tax troubles than for his music. While World War II was on, Herman had hawked war bonds and he'd cut V-discs for GIs. But when the IRS later discovered a crooked manager had been cooking his books, the feds showed the band leader no mercy. It was an important story and it made great copy, but it's not what Woody Herman should be remembered for. In a sense, he'd been rewarded for his wartime good works almost immediately. His first two post-war bands, the First and Second Herds, were his most exciting and distinctive. A sampling of their stuff is on a Columbia reissue, The Thundering Herds, 1945 to 1947. Though the big bands were then on the wane, Herman was ripe for a breakthrough. He'd played the blues for years, had commissioned early bop charts from Dizzy Gillespie, and had been smitten by Duke Ellington's sound. Herman's post-war music was an agreeable hodgepodge of those strains. Here's a taste of John Laporta's Non-Alcoholic. The spark plug that ignited the First Herd was bassist Chubby Jackson. He's sort of a missing link between Basie's hard-swinging bassist Walter Page, who set the style in the 30s, and the early 60s high-note virtuoso Scott LaFaro. Listen to Jackson push tenorist Flip Phillips on Apple Honey. He builds tension just by dropping a few notes from his hyperactive line. Herman valued great soloists, but had a modest opinion of his own talents. In the First Herd, he showcased Phillips and trombonist Bill Harris more than he did himself. Harris, like the boppers to come, was so adept with his slide, some listeners assumed he played the more prim valve trombone. But he combined that precision with a blustery approach. He'd dramatically shape every note like an old tailgate trombonist. One of Harris's features was a rumba by Ralph Burns, Bijou. Seizure was recorded in 1945. 3 years later, J.J. Johnson's bop trombone was the rage, and Harris's rich sound seemed old-fashioned. Tastes and the economy were changing. Woody Herman disbanded the first herd at the end of 1946, but he was back with a second herd the following year. Bill Harris, Chubby Jackson, and Flip Phillips were gone, but the new band's up-and-coming players included Stan Getz and Zoot Sims. The second herd has had more lasting impact, too, thanks to Jimmy Giuffre's chart for harmonized saxes, Four Brothers. It was a fluent and influential marriage of Benny Carter's block voicings with the new language of bop. Herman's first two herds cut dozens of sides between 1945 and 47. The new reissue isn't the ideal selection. The second herd is represented by only two cuts out of 16. There are three Herman vocals where one would be plenty. And a couple of these bands' best love numbers are missing. Presumably, Columbia is saving them for a sequel, if this collection sells as well as it ought to. Woody Herman should be remembered for his best music, and not just for the terrible things that happened to people around April 15th.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed a new Woody Herman reissue, The Thundering Herds, 1945 to 1947, on the Columbia label.
A jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou, baby, I dreamed we sat beneath the scented bough. Baby, your eyes.
That's Woody Herman, and this is Fresh Air. With few exceptions, travel and road books have long been the domain of men. Mary Morris's new book is one of those exceptions. Her book, Nothing to Declare, chronicles her solo journey through Mexico and Central America. Morris describes the people she befriended along the way, as well as what she ultimately learned about herself from being a single woman far from home. She writes, "As a woman alone, I have never been raped or wounded or kidnapped or tortured, but I have been left and betrayed, bewildered and afraid." I asked her what prompted her trip.
I think that I was tired of some things in New York. I'd been living here a long time, and I felt I wanted a really different experience than anything that I'd had before. I'd lived in Europe and traveled in Europe, and I basically wanted a third world experience.
There's another reason that you also offer for why you like to travel, and you say that sometimes you think change will come in the form of a new circumstance or a new man.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe less the man. I think that probably less now. But I think that travel does provide certain kinds of opportunities for change on many levels, I think, inner and outer and way we see the world. I think Latin America changed me in ways that I didn't expect it to change me. That was sort of the surprise of the trip for me, actually. Well, it was more than a trip. It was a living experience. But the surprise was I think I went for a new experience, and instead what I found was a different kind of people and a different way of seeing the world.
And how did that change you?
I think I changed my priorities. I think that when you live in a place like Latin America and you see sort of life and death situations every day, you think differently about what's important, you know, in your life. And I think that a lot of times in New York or in America, we don't quite face the world in quite the same way. I mean, for example, I think relationships with people became more important to me after that.
Is there a kind of travel writing that you especially like? Have you read a lot of books about being on the road?
You know, I'll answer this really frankly. A lot of the ones that I've read tend to denigrate the people that they're traveling among, and I have a lot of problems, and I will say particularly male writers, I think, who tend to sort of look down on the people they are traveling among, and I do have a lot of problems with that. And also, I think that there's a lack of the personal in travel writing that I've tried to put into this book, and You know, certainly you have different kinds of encounters when you're traveling. People touch you in different ways. You may have a love affair. You may make a connection with somebody that you wouldn't have made in other ways. And I think that's really lacking from, to me, that's what travel is about. It's about the human connections that I make as I'm journeying. And I found that missing from travel writing.
You know, I always think that you need a strong sense of identity in order to spend a lot of time on the road.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do it and not feel lost or not feel like a voyeur of other people's lives. Do you find that to be true, that you really have to know who you are if you're spending months on the road?
I think that's really true. But I also think it's true that at those moments when you don't know who you are and when you feel very lost, you just have to go with it, you know. And I think, I don't think I knew who I was when I was setting out, but I also think you shouldn't be afraid if you have a moment where you suddenly feel lost and you don't know.
Do you still find, though, that as a woman traveling alone, you're treated differently than you would be, A, if you were traveling with a man, or B, if you were a man?
I think it matters a little bit where you are. I mean, I traveled through the Soviet Union and China a couple years ago alone, and it was a very different kind of experience than in Latin America. I never felt, for example, threatened with a situation of rape or assault or something like that when I was in communist countries. So that was very different. Latin America, it's different. You're dealing with a macho culture. The Middle East is still different. So I think a lot of it depends on where you go.
Did you feel in Latin America that when you were walking alone without any company, that you were always being sized up, evaluated, that someone was always ready to come on to you in some way?
You know, actually, I didn't feel that. I think that's a little bit of a misperception of the Latin male. I mean, I think you can feel that way walking down Fifth Avenue, quite frankly. I mean...
Well, that's absolutely right.
Right. So I think it's not necessarily just Latin America. I think it's just about anywhere.
Did you figure out certain tricks of making yourself look unavailable when you were traveling alone so that people wouldn't hassle you?
I sometimes wore a wedding ring when I traveled, and that helped in certain places. I did that in the Middle East, actually. I wore a wedding ring. And I think sometimes just looking as if you can carry your own baggage, inner and outer. You know, if you look like you can carry yourself along, people are less prone to bother you than if you look vulnerable and helpless. You know, and I mean whether you can carry your suitcase or whether you seem lost or frazzled. I think looking like you know where you're going really makes a difference. And people are more prone to respect you, I think, if you have that, you know, presence.
You've learned how to travel light.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things you used to take with you when you traveled that you realized weren't really necessary and you learned to leave behind?
Well, are we talking about clothing or are we talking about internal things? I think we're
Let's start with objects.
There was a time, I mean, this is going to sound really crazy, where I took a little typewriter with me because, I mean, I like to write.
You're a writer. That doesn't sound crazy
to
me.
Yeah, but, dragging a typewriter through, you know, certain parts of the world is pretty ridiculous. And what I really learned to do was get a certain kind of journal that I liked and that I liked to carry and take some nice pens, and I worked by hand.
Now, what about emotional baggage that you learned to leave behind?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one memory that's real strong for me, which was I went to France when I was a junior in college, and my mother stood on the dock in New York and waved goodbye to me, and she kissed me goodbye, and she said, "You take yourself with you." And that really stuck in my mind, the thought that you can't run away from who or what you are, and the difficulties that you have at home or with friends or whatever, they're going to go with you on the road. And I think a lot of traveling light is just learning how to get rid of some of the inner difficulties that we carry with us and not expect them to go away when we're on the road, because they're not going to go away then. It might be a time to work out certain things that are difficult in terms of independence and being with other people, learning how to be alone, which is hard for a lot of people.
You know, I think when you're on the road without a specific goal in mind, that frequently you can get homesick,
mm-hmm.
and you have to fight that to kind of keep traveling.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, you know that it's time to go home. How can you tell the difference?
Mm-hmm. I guess what you feel is that there are some times when you just have to work through or live through a moment that's difficult in a journey. And there are other times when you really feel you've reached your goal. I mean, when I went Trans-Siberia in 1986, I got on the train in Peking, and I went to Moscow, and I spent a few weeks wandering through the Soviet Union. And then I realized I was supposed to fly home from Moscow, and I realized that what I really wanted to do was get back on the train and get to the Berlin Wall. I wanted to go wall to wall, and that was what I did. And I felt it wasn't done in Moscow. I felt I had to get back, and I wanted the train to take me out of the east into the west. So it was just a feeling, and I went with it, you know.
What about your trip to Mexico and Central America? How did you know when that was over?
I think I ran out of money. I'm sorry. I think that's the reality. I think I needed a job, and it was time to come home, and I'd run out of my grant money, and I was offered a job back in New York, and I'd been away over a year and a half, and it just felt like time. And I had felt some changes were made that I was ready to get home and test it back here.
What's a change that you wanted to test when you got back?
Well, this is personal, but I'm just going to say it. I mean, I felt that I'd really learned how to care for people in a different way by being down there, and I really wondered if I could take that back to where I came from and be able to care for my family and my friends and the people I came into contact with in a different way than I had, but maybe a more generous way than I had before. I mean, it's easy to be generous with the Latins because they're so generous, and I wondered if I could bring that home. I think to some extent I have. I think it's not always easy. I think there's a lot of struggling, particularly in New York, but I think that my relationships are all deeper for it. I think I've tried to be more generous with people.
Well, you have a daughter now, right?
I do. I have a daughter.
How old is she now?
14 months.
Now, are you going to be traveling with her?
Yeah, actually, I do have an idea of taking off for a year with her when she's a little bit older. She's a great traveler, and I'm hoping we will.
You know, you discussed before the importance of learning how to travel light. It's certainly impossible to do when you're traveling with a baby.
Yes, I'm going to have well, what I'm thinking actually now is a kind of camper or car through America. I think that's probably the way to go. I think that obviously with a child, you just can't. They just need too many things. And also, I'm not going to take any risks with her. She's too important to me, and I just can't imagine. You know, I'm living right now 2 hours from Tijuana, and I love Mexico, and I haven't set foot there since I've been living in California because I'm a little nervous about taking her down at this age. I think in a couple of years we'll go more places. I'm thinking of the South Seas. What do you think?
Well, yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, South Pacific or something like that.
Well, I wish you good travels, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mary Morris is the author of Nothing to Declare, Memoirs of a Woman Traveling Alone. You're listening to Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we have an update on the hijacking of the Kuwaiti airliner. And also, I talked to an expert on terrorism, asked him about what it is that motivates hijackers, and especially when they virtually never get what they demand. A report also on the aftermath of the big roundup in Los Angeles this past weekend of gang members. Hundreds of gang members had been hauled in on assorted charges. And we look tonight at a couple of new children's programs, Double Dare and I'm Telling. They're game shows for kids. To win prizes, the kids are encouraged to act like adult game show contestants, which in a word, Terry, is...
humiliation?
Dumb.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fans of the TV cop show Hill Street Blues may have spent the past couple of seasons watching Hill Street reruns and hoping for something to fill the void. There's a new show called The Street beginning this week. Television critic David Bianculli says it may look like the real thing, but it isn't.
182. Hey folks, there's a new cop show in town. The show is called The Street and the town is Newark, New Jersey. It premieres this week on Superstation WWOR, and it's being shopped around in syndication. A lot of critics are already going crazy about it, so this nightly half-hour cop show may actually catch on. The Street is supposed to be this bold new TV show because of how and where it's produced. It's videotaped like a documentary, with cameras squirreled away in the backs of patrol cars, outside of donut shops, and on the darkest of mean streets. Each episode tags along with a pair of actors who play officers on an 8-hour shift, and follows them as they do their jobs, drink their coffee, and talk about their lives. In a way, it's like Hill Street Blues without the precinct house, and without the good scriptwriters, but I'll get to that later. What critics are raving about so far is the way The Street uses the streets of Newark. The show is shot entirely on location, which supposedly adds to the realism. There are times when it works. In this scene, two cop cars are pulled alongside one another, and the officers in one squad car are asking the cops in the other car about their most recent arrest. The cops had responded to a shoplifting call and arrived to find that the liquor store manager had locked the thieves in his walk-in refrigerator.
We get there, and Ralph, the liquor store owner, has got these two PRs locked in the walk-in refrigerator.
Locked in.
These guys don't speak any English at all, but somehow Ralphie herds them in and calls the cops. Mm-hmm. He caught them stealing a couple of packs of Twinkies.
That's it.
That's it?
When we get there, these guys' lips are turning blue. Ralphie's lucky we didn't bust him, man. He's lucky he didn't crawl, because he'd be the one doing the time. You know what I mean?
So what'd you do with them?
What'd I do with them? What do you think I did with him, man? I take him into custody, of course.
Yeah. You took them into custody?
Of course.
What are you, Jack Webb?
I'm glad these guys remember Jack Webb, because Webb's Dragnet, and especially his production of Adam 12, did in Hollywood what The Street is trying to do in Newark: look at police work from a cop's eye view. The Street also owes a lot to Hill Street Blues and to the filmmaking style of Robert Altman, but judging from the first week of shows, doesn't belong in that league. The show has a few good actors: Stanley Tucci, who just played Mosca the bad guy on Miami Vice, and Michael Beach, as a new cop on patrol, play their scenes nicely. The bottom line, though, is that The Street is about as believable and well-written as the average daytime soap opera. It may look real, but it very rarely sounds real. You end up admiring the camera work, not caring about the characters. Where this show succeeds 100% is as a production deal. Since WWOR moved from New York to New Jersey, it was looking for projects that could relate to its community. The Street fills that bill nicely. And speaking of bills, The Street is a lot cheaper to make than a cop show with studio overhead, and it ought to sell well in late-night syndication. As a business deal, The Street is perfect. But perfect business deals seldom make for perfect TV shows. The producers ought to put out an APB for better writers, fast.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I speak with image consultant Dorothy Sarnoff. One of her specialties is coaching people before they're interviewed on radio and television. She's coached some people I've interviewed, and I want to know what kind of advice she's given them. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward reminds nostalgia addicts and revisionists that even in the old days, rock and roll took on sex and frustration. And book critic John Leonard reviews Getting Better, reporter Nan Robertson's look at Alcoholics Anonymous. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.